range. If Harnack's numbers may overreach, possibly it is most reasonable simply to have this figure and think generally of something like 2 to 3 million Christians in the year 300. Possibly it was slightly less. As we will see in a moment, given the rate of Christian growth, surprisingly enough, the exact number does not matter much. The demographics of conversion. First, it is important to consider several matters of demographics. The vast bulk of the ancient population comprised lower classes. The very upper crust of the aristocracy, the senators of Rome, the next level down, known as the equestrians, and the local elite of cities throughout the empire called decurions, altogether made up just over 1% of the total population. With respect to the other 99%, there was not much of a middle class to speak of in Rome's non-capitalist pre-industrial society. There were, to be sure, large differences in wealth, even in a world where the great majority of people were living on the economic edge. But the majority of people did live on that edge, including most of the people coming into the Christian faith. Pagan intellectuals, such as Celsus, may have mocked Christians for being attractive principally to the poor and uneducated, but the reality is that this was most of the population. For reasons I have already explained, it proved much easier to convert people in urban settings than in rural ones. The urban centers were packed with people. Rome itself had a population of nearly 200 persons per acre, and the number on the ground was much higher than that, since about a quarter of the city was public space without housing. Such dense populations made human interchange much more frequent than in rural settings. As McMullen points out, the narrower one's house, the more time would naturally be spent among one's neighbors, the more intercourse and friendliness, the more gossip and exchange of news and sense of fraternity, and accordingly, the more opportunities for conversion. As information about this new cult could spread like wildfire, no less quickly than rumor and gossip. It is clear that Christianity grew at different rates in different cities and regions. Both literary and archaeological sources confirm there were far more converts in the East than the West in the first 300 years. It was not until the end of the 2nd century that Western provinces began to be seriously Christianized at all. Rome itself was an obvious exception. Moreover, some parts of the East, for example Asia Minor, saw Christian growth much more quickly than others. Egypt is a good example. One of the fascinating studies of the Christianization of Egypt was undertaken by a Roger Bagnall, at the time a professor of ancient history at Columbia. Bagnall applied an interesting method for determining how quickly Egypt became Christianized. It had to do with a field called onomastics, the study of personal names. As Christianity spread throughout the empire, Christians started giving their children Christian names. As an obvious example, Peter was not a name at all in antiquity before Christians arrived on the scene. The name Peter is based on a nickname given to one of Jesus' disciples, Simon, son of Jonah, John chapter 1, verse 42. It is a word that means rock. We are not sure why Jesus wanted to call Simon the rock, but he did. And years afterward, Christians would sometimes give their children the name of this famous disciple. Non-Christians had no inclination to do so. Some names are thus definitely Christian, and if enough documents survive from any region, such as tax records, marriage certificates, and land deeds, it is possible to determine what people are named at different periods of time, and on that basis to calculate how many of those people were Christian, based at least on the naming practices. As it turns out, we see very few traces of Christianity in Egypt before the middle of the 3rd century, unlike, say, the city of Rome, which had a large church already in Paul's day. For most of the time prior to the conversion of Constantine, Egypt was almost entirely pagan. It was not completely so, as we know of some Christians and Christian literary activity there, especially in Alexandria. But Christians were hugely outnumbered by pagans until the end of the 3rd century. Then, there was a striking shift. On the basis of his initial analysis, Bagnall argued that Christians had become half of the population sometime between 318 and 330 CE. 75% of the population by the middle of the 4th century, and 90% by the end of the century. These results, he maintained, can be confirmed from other evidence, records in our surviving papyri, inscriptions, and literary sources such as the hagiographic tales of the Egyptian saints. Thus, the growth of Christianity in Egypt did not parallel the situation in Rome, or Antioch, or Jerusalem. Each place was different. This idea that Christianization was wildly uneven throughout the empire is not new or controversial. Already, Harnack had differentiated rates of growth as he identified some places where, by the year 312 CE, Christianity was nearly half the population. For example, Asia Minor, Armenia, Cyprus. Where it was less than half but very strong, Antioch, parts of Egypt, parts of Italy, Spain. Where it was very sparse, Palestine, Phoenicia, Arabia. And where it hardly existed at all, Upper Italy, Middle and Upper Gaul, Germany. These basic findings have been confirmed by further analyses in recent times. As cited, for example, by Frank Trumbly, a leading expert on the Christianization of the empire, who not only reconsidered all of the literary evidence adduced by Harnack, but examined scattered inscriptions, remains of papyri, and archaeological findings. These kinds of evidence allow us to speak more authoritatively about the presence of Christianity in specific cities, towns, and rural areas. Trumbly noted that the newer evidence tends to support the findings of Harnack, but also provides some important nuance. Among other things, it appears that major cities serving as capitals of provinces, places such as Rome, Antioch, and Thessalonica, did not become predominantly Christian until the middle of the 4th century. Fairly large regional towns in the provinces at the time were often roughly balanced between pagans and Christians then. But many places, such as Athens, Delphi, and Gaza, remained predominantly pagan, even into the early 5th century. The growth of Christianity, in short, was uneven. People converted in different numbers in different times and places. The rate of Christian growth. Still, it may be possible to calculate some very rough sense of the rate of Christian growth over the first few centuries. That will require a bit of number crunching. And there is no one better at crunching numbers than a sociologist. It was indeed a sociologist, Rodney Stark, a specialist in modern religious movements, who made the first serious attempt at establishing Christian growth rates in the first several centuries in his popular book, The Rise of Christianity. Suffice it to say here that Stark's numbers need to be nuanced for a variety of reasons, even if his overall thesis appears to be rock solid. The triumph of Christianity over the pagan religions of Rome did not require a miracle from on high. It required a steady growth in the church, one convert after the other, year after year for the first three centuries. Once Stark's numbers are appropriately tweaked, it is clear that Christianity was growing only at a rate, very roughly, of 30% or so per decade for the majority of this period. In other words, if there are 100 Christians this year, there need to be another 30 or so 10 years from now. If we start right at the beginning, immediately after Jesus' death, here are rough estimates of the number of Christians at key moments of the movement. 30 CE, 20 Christians. 60 CE, 1,000 to 1,500 Christians. 100 CE, 7,000 to 10,000 Christians. 150 CE, 30,000 to 40,000 Christians. 200 CE, 140,000 to around 170,000 Christians. 250 CE, 600,000 to 700,000 Christians. 300 CE, 2.5 million to 3.5 million Christians. 312 CE, 3.5 million to 4 million Christians. 400 CE, 25 to 35 million Christians. To non-statisticians, these raw numbers may sound incredible, but in fact they are simply the result of an exponential curve. If 25 to 30,000 Christians were added in the half century between 100 and 150 CE, then at the very same rate of growth during the half century between 250 and 300 CE, something like 2 million or 2.5 million Christians would be added. A steady rate of growth eventually provided enormous numbers. For example, if there were just 2.5 to 3.5 million Christians in the year 300, the church would have to grow only at a rate of 26% to reach 30 million by the year 400. I need to stress that we are not talking about implausible rates of growth, even though the numbers at the end of the period are staggering. For the 4th century, if the rate really was around 25% per decade, That would only mean that every 100 Christians would need to convert just 2 or occasionally 3 people a year. In that regard, it is important to remember that conversions include everyone who begins to adopt Christian practices. If the head of a household converts and he brings his wife and 3 children into the fold, so that they too adopt the new faith, then you have 5 new members. We know these kinds of family conversions occurred from the very beginning of the Christian movement. They are recounted in the book of Acts as a matter of course, as if there was nothing at all unusual about members of a household joining the paterfamilias, or even the materfamilias in the faith. And so when Paul and his companions are in Philippi, they convert a wealthy woman named Lydia, and immediately she and her household were baptized. Acts chapter 16, verses 14 and 15. Soon thereafter, an unnamed jailer learns he must believe in Jesus to be saved, and he and his entire family were baptized without delay. Acts chapter 16, verse 33. I'm not saying these accounts are necessarily historical, but the author of Acts saw nothing at all unusual in an entire family joining in the new faith of the head of the household. It would thus be a relatively simple matter for the church to grow at a rate of 2.5% per year, the rough rate of growth we are hypothesizing for the 4th century. It would simply mean that every group of 100 Christians would have to witness 1 male adult convert along with his small family every 2 years. That would make the church grow from 3 million to about 30 million in just the 4th century. The rate of growth does not have to be vastly different if, at the beginning of the century, there were only 2 million Christians, just under 3% a year. Some implications. In a discussion of Christian growth in the first 4 centuries, Roman historian Keith Hopkins drew out some intriguing implications of the numbers of conversions that had been discussed by Stark. I have tried to provide some nuance for these numbers while allowing broader figures, but for the most part, they are not radically different from Stark's, and many of the implications are very much the same. I have already discussed the exaggerated claims of various ancient sources. We can now consider these in light of more sensible estimates. Clearly, the book of Acts cannot be right that within 2 months or so of Jesus' death, there were some 10,000 Christians in Jerusalem. Nor can Tertullian be right that around 200 CE, the majority of people in the empire were Christian, not even close. Suppose our figures are roughly correct, that in the year 100 there were possibly 7,000 to 10,000 Christians. How does that figure in the overall population of the empire? Were Christians likely to have been seen as a growing threat? Recall the empire, by rough calculation, numbered something like 60 million. If there were 10,000 Christians, that would make the Christian portion of the population about 0.0167%, that is, 1/60th of 1%. The vast majority of Romans had never heard of Christians. The idea that Christians were about to take over would have been laughable. If by 200 CE Christians numbered in the vicinity of 160,000 people, that still would be just a tiny fragment of the population, 0.267%, or somewhat over 1/4 of 1%. Even though the church was growing by relative leaps and bounds, it still would have been a completely unknown quantity to most Romans. It was only in the 3rd century that the numbers began to grow significantly, think compound interest, and then to avalanche in the 4th. In Hopkins' study, he poses the interesting questions: how many actual Christian communities were there in the early decades? And how many writings did they generate? Both are very hard to answer. In his comprehensive survey of all of our surviving literary sources, Harnack was able to identify about 50 Christian communities by name by 100 CE. How many communities were not mentioned by our sources? I would assume most of them. So were there 150 communities in the empire by then? Or 300? We don't really know. But suppose there were 50. Hopkins plays with the figures and comes up with some fascinating ideas. We know that early Christian communities were in contact with one another, often simply by writing a letter, one community leader to another, often in the name of the community itself. And so Paul wrote letters to his communities, and we know that his communities wrote letters to him, as he himself indicates in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. Let's say that between the years 50 and 150 CE, these 50 known communities each wrote just 2 letters a year. That's not much. I would think they wrote more. but Hopkins asks us to suppose they wrote on average only twice. That would mean that over that century, there would have been 10,000 Christian letters sent back and forth. How many of these letters do we have today? About 50. Hopkins' numbers seem to me, and probably to him, far too conservative. Suppose there were actually 200 communities in the year 100. That seems plausible. If there were just over 8,000 Christians, then that would mean each community would have on average about 40 members. It is hard to imagine a community being much larger than that, since Christians were still meeting in private homes, and few places could accommodate even 36 persons. But suppose there were 200 communities, and suppose they each wrote a letter just once, every 3 months, or 4 a year. That would mean that there would have been 80,000 Christian letters produced in the period, represented now in just the 50 that survive. The sheer number boggles the mind. Hopkins is also interested in the question of how many people in these communities could actually read or write these letters. He points out that as a rule of thumb, any ancient community would be made up of 30% adult males, 30% adult females, and 40% children. The people who could read would be found principally among the adult males. The best indications suggest that maybe 20% of the adult male population could read. If all these numbers are right, and that an average community consisted of 40 people, then 12 of those would be adult males. That would suggest that just 2 or 3 people in the community were literate. Those would be the ones who did the writing and the reading. Letters sent back and forth to the churches would not have been read by most Christians, but to them by the literate 2 or 3. One of those 2 or 3 would in almost every instance have been the bishop or leader of the church. He, always a male so far as we know, would be a leader precisely because he had the skills needed to lead, and those skills would have involved some degree of education. Thus, although Christianity was from the outset a religion that depended to an unusual extent on literature, most Christians were illiterate, as was most of the population of the empire. Those without an education were dependent on others for the reading and interpretation of the texts that were used in their communal worship. The growth of the Christian church, in sum. Even though the numbers of Christians and the rates of growth are of necessity rough estimates, they do appear to coincide with the surviving data. Both the literary evidence evaluated at length by Harnack and others after him, as well as the material remains from Christian antiquity. Inscriptions on stone, writing on papyri, and an assortment of archaeological finds. We may not be able to chart Christian growth with precision, but we can do so approximately. And even these imprecise finds are highly suggestive. Several points bear repeating. It would not take a divine miracle for Christianity to win over the empire. Christians may well want to claim it was a miracle, that it was ultimately God's doing. The historian has no way of evaluating that claim, but the triumph of Christianity would not have required supernatural intervention. It would have required a steady rate of growth as people converted for reasons I laid out in the preceding chapters. There was no need for massive conversions at large evangelistic rallies. We have almost no record of any full-time evangelists after the days of Paul, of missionaries or organized missions of any kind. People converted because they knew other people who were Christian, people connected to them in their daily lives, members of their families, friends, neighbors, co-workers. Many Christians were quite happy to talk about their new faith, about the great miracles that had been worked by and for those who believed, the divine power that was more readily available to those who worshiped the Christian God than to anyone who worshiped any other divine being. These Christians proved convincing. Not massively, just occasionally. That is all it took. Perhaps most surprising is the fact that the ultimate triumph of Christianity did not require the conversion of the Emperor Constantine. As I've been stressing throughout this book, that conversion was indeed important, one of the most breathtaking moments in Christian history. Christianity went from persecuted minority to favored religion, nearly in one fell swoop. Certainly this opened the floodgates, in the sense that now the upper classes within the Roman administration, that rarefied 1% of the educated, cultured, and wealthy elite, could see their way to adopting the Christian faith. Christian buildings could now be constructed with no dread of reprisal. The masses could join the faith without fearing for their lives or property. And Christianity grew enormously from, say, 2.5 or 3 million at the beginning of the 4th century to 30 million at the end. but it would be a mistake to think that it was Constantine's conversion alone that facilitated the Christianization of the empire. If Christianity had simply continued to grow at the rate it was growing at the end of the emperor's conversion, or even less, it still would have eventually taken over. It is impossible to say what would have happened if Constantine had not converted. One could argue that had the Romans been even more determined to stamp out the faith, they could have done so. Or one could argue the opposite, that even more rigorous Roman opposition would have hardened the Christians' resolve and made them more fervent in the propagation of their religion, making true Tertullian's claim that the blood of martyrs was the seed of the church. We will never know what might have happened. But we do know what did happen. Constantine converted at an opportune moment. Christianity was poised to grow exponentially, even as its rate of growth slowed. The masses did begin to pour in. The emperor showered favors on a religion that excluded the possibility of all other worship. From that point on, looking at the matter in hindsight, the pagan cults of Rome were doomed. An exclusive commitment to the one God of the Christians destroyed the other religions in its wake. Within 80 years of Constantine's conversion, the transformation would be both massive and official. Rome would become predominantly and officially Christian. Chapter 7. Christians under assault. Persecution, martyrdom, and self-defense. Even though the church experienced remarkable growth during its first three centuries, the empire's transition from paganism to Christianity was by no means smooth. The pagan world did not yield to this new faith quietly. From the very beginning, with the pre-Christian activities of Paul, up until the conversion of Constantine, Christians encountered firm, sometimes even feverish opposition. Some of this opposition entailed nothing more than social shunning and verbal attack. But sometimes it involved actual physical assault, either from enraged mobs or by Roman officials intent on punishing those who claimed the name of Christ. Eventually, the imperial authorities tried to stamp out the religion altogether. In this chapter, we will examine these setbacks along the road to Christianity's triumph. At the outset, I need to stress that organized opposition to the Christians came, for the most part, in isolated incidents. The church did not experience perennial violent persecution. The idea that Christianity was an illegal religion under constant surveillance by a state apparatus that inflicted martyrdom on many thousands of believers, forcing the church underground into the Roman catacombs, all this is more the stuff of Hollywood than of history. Christianity was not declared illegal in the empire before the middle of the 3rd century. There were no empire-wide laws or decrees issued by the central authorities in Rome that prescribed the faith. Christians did not, as a rule, go into hiding. For the most part, they lived perfectly normal lives in the midst of other people who practiced a wide variety of other religions. The catacombs were not meeting places for Christians forced to congregate in clandestine cells for fear of violent persecution. Persecution itself was rare, and there were relatively few casualties. But it did happen on occasion, and there were indeed some ghastly incidents involving trials, tortures, and horrific executions. One might wonder why they happened at all. There were thousands of other religions in the empire. No one was required to worship just one god or another. It was no crime to add a god to the hundreds already revered, not even the god of the Christians. Nor was it a crime to consider a human being, such as Jesus, a god. Many pagans did so with impunity. Given the wide variety of religious cults in the empire, and the abundant tolerance and open display every minute of every day, both among the general populace and by the ruling authorities, why would Christians occasionally find themselves, or more commonly hear of others, arrested, tried, and tortured? And why was the judicial goal not to get them to confess to a crime they had committed, but to force them to stop committing it? First, we should recall that even though Roman authorities were highly tolerant of religious differences, they were not infinitely so, as the Roman suppression of the Bacchic rites in Rome in 186 BCE demonstrates. Any religious cult perceived to be flagrantly immoral or dangerous to society was subject to official intervention. Its members could be tried and punished, and the cult itself could be locally proscribed. The Christians discovered this early in their history. On occasion throughout this period, most dramatically as we will see, in 250, 257 to 258, and 303 to 313 CE. Authorities intervene to disrupt the Christian's religious practices and force, or try to force, its adherents to abandon the faith. This was not because the Christian religion was illegal per se. It was because the Christians were perceived as dangerous, either to the social well-being of a local community or eventually to the ongoing health of the entire empire. Early persecution of the Christians. We have already discussed the persecution of Christians by the Jewish antagonist Paul, who experienced violent opposition himself after his conversion. That discussion will suffice for the question of how and why non-Christian Jews in the early years of the church opposed the movement. In this chapter, we shift our focus to Roman persecution. As one might expect, the earliest references to such persecution come to us in the New Testament and are once more related to the missionary work of the Apostle Paul. Just as Paul tells his readers in Corinth that he had on five occasions received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes minus one, he says that on three other occasions he was beaten with rods, 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 24 and 25. This was a form of Roman corporal punishment. Paul never explains the nature of the charges or of the judicial proceedings leading to these punishments. We do, however, find several episodes in the book of Acts that address the issue. As we have seen, Acts is not a disinterested historical account of what happened in the early years of the Christian movement, even if it is often uncritically read in that way. The episodes it narrates may or may not have occurred. But for it to work as a piece of literature in its own first century setting, Acts certainly had to be plausible to its readers. Even if its accounts of what happened in the lives of Paul and the others may not be accurate in their specifics, they do represent the sorts of things that could have been expected to happen. These would include Paul's experiences of Roman persecution. One of the earliest episodes can illustrate the point. In Acts 16, on his second missionary journey, Paul and his companions are in the city of Philippi, where they encounter a young female slave who is possessed by a demon that allows her to predict the future. Her owners make a nice income from her peculiar abilities. But she hounds and publicly maligns Paul, who, after several irritating days, exorcises the demon. Acts chapter 16, verses 16 through 18. The slave's owners are incensed at having lost their business. Seizing Paul and one of his companions, they drag them before the local magistrates and charge, "These men are Jews, and they are disturbing our city. They are proclaiming customs that we as Romans are not allowed to accept or practice." Acts chapter 16, verses 20 and 21. The crowd joins in on the attacks, and the magistrates decide that punishment is in order. They sentence the apostles to be stripped naked, beaten with rods, and thrown in prison. As one comes to expect in the book of Acts, later that night God intervenes on behalf of his chosen ones, causing an earthquake that shakes off their shackles and opens the doors of the prison, allowing them to walk out free. The divine earthquake may not be creditable, but the general tenor of the persecution is. The views and activities of the Christians are seen as un-Roman, harmful, and dangerous, leading local magistrates to take appropriate action. These actions are not based on laws that have been passed against the Christians. There were no such laws. Followers of Jesus were sometimes considered troublemakers and treated accordingly. Roman officials had the authority to deal with such issues on their own with rather broad latitude. They could punish those causing problems, or even those thought likely to cause problems, without having to consult legal codes or precedent. Other sources show that it was not long before simply being known as a Christian could lead to serious opposition. Within the New Testament, we find the little book of 1 Peter, one of the real gems among the early Christian writings. Comprising a mere five chapters, this book places an unusually strong focus on the issue of anti-Christian opposition. The word suffer occurs more in this book than in the entire 28-chapter book of Acts. We learn here that some Christians are paying a price for their faith. We need to assume this means some kind of local opposition, and there is no indication whatsoever that the author has in mind an empire-wide persecution. But the suffering was real. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial that has come upon you, as if it is something unexpected. But insofar as you share in the sufferings of Christ, rejoice, so that you may also rejoice and find joy when he is revealed in glory. You are blessed if you are reproached for the name of Christ. None of you ought to suffer as a murderer, thief, evildoer, or mischief maker. But if you suffer as a Christian, do not be ashamed, but glorify God by this name. 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 12 through 14. The author is vague concerning what this suffering entailed. It is clear, in any event, that it was awful. He calls it a fiery ordeal. And it would come upon the community simply because it was Christian. This kind of suffering was acceptable and pleasing to God, whereas criminal and mischievous activity, obviously, was not. Some light may be cast on this ordeal by an earlier comment in which the author tells his readers they are no longer to live according to human passions, but by the will of God. The Christian's friends and neighbors do not appreciate this kind of new lifestyle, but the author insists, "The past time is sufficient for doing what the Gentiles prefer, going about in licentiousness, desires, addiction to wine, reveling, carousing, and lawless idolatry. They are surprised when you no longer accompany them in wild profligacy, and they verbally attack you." 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. It may well be that in the early stages of the Christian movement, as converts move their allegiance from families, friends, and neighbors to their new Christian community, they upset and angered those left behind, who then abused them for it. It is hard to know exactly how this might have led to corporal punishment, but it may be that the secretive meetings of Christians and their antisocial behavior began not only to upset individual members of the wider community, but also drew the attention of local magistrates, who suspected nefarious activities. Questions of legitimacy eventually concerned not only the ethical and social activities of the Christians, but even more, their religious cult itself, the worship of just one God, and the refusal to participate in the religious life of the larger community. That this became the salient issue in pagan opposition to the Christian community becomes crystal clear from sources outside the New Testament. The persecution of Pliny. The first detailed account of a Roman judicial proceeding against Christians foreshadows what was occasionally to happen in subsequent years. It comes to us in the early 2nd century letters of Pliny the Younger, the Roman governor of the province of Bithynia Pontus in northwest Asia Minor. This Pliny is called the Younger because he was adopted by an uncle, Pliny the Elder, an equally famous Roman official and author best known for his scientific writings on natural history and for dying during the most catastrophic natural disaster of his time. Following the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 CE, Pliny the Elder attempted a sea rescue of some who were trapped, and he died in the cataclysm. His nephew recorded his own observation of the volcano from afar, along with numerous other incidents in his life, in a large collection of his letters in 10 books. They are among the most extensive, informative, and intriguing sets of correspondence to come down to us from the ancient world. Book 10 contains 61 letters Pliny exchanged with the Emperor Trajan from 110 to 113 CE. Particularly important for our purposes are letters 96 and 97, the first containing Pliny's only references to Christians and his judicial proceeding against them, the second setting forth the Emperor's very brief response. Pliny wrote letter 96 because Christians had been brought to his attention, and he was not certain that his treatment of them followed acceptable protocols. There obviously was not a law against Christians or any official procedure for dealing with them, or Pliny would not have needed to inquire. He knew that something was to be done, but he was not sure what. As he says at the outset of the letter, "It is my regular custom, my lord, to refer to you all questions which cause me doubt, for who can better guide my hesitant steps or instruct my ignorance? I have never attended hearings concerning Christians, so I am unaware what is usually punished or investigated, and to what extent." Clearly, there had been official proceedings against Christians before, but they must have been relatively few and far between. Pliny, a highly placed Roman official, had never attended one and did not know what they entailed. He asks the emperor whether the age of a Christian should be a matter of consideration, whether a Christian who has recanted the faith should still be held liable, and whether it is simply the name Christian that is actionable, or if instead actual crimes attendant to the name are to be punished. He goes on then to explain how, in the absence of any law or known precedent, he has proceeded. When a person was accused of being a Christian, Pliny would simply ask if the charge was true. If the person confessed, he then gave the person 2 chances to recant, under threat of execution. If the person persisted in remaining a Christian, Pliny ordered execution on the grounds of obduracy in the face of imperial power, for refusing to obey the orders of a Roman official. Christians who could show they were Roman citizens, however, were sent to Rome for trial, one of the privileges of citizenship. What the term Christian actually meant and why it was a capital offense becomes clear in Pliny's fuller explanation of his procedure. If a person claimed not to be a Christian, Pliny made them prove it. He brought cult statues of the gods and of the emperor into the courtroom and ordered the person to do obeisance, to offer up a sacrifice of wine and incense, and to curse the name of Christ. Anyone who refused was obviously a Christian and was taken off for execution. Those who complied were acquitted of all charges. This was a clever test, and it showed why the term Christian itself was punishable. Those who genuinely claimed that name would refuse to worship the gods and the emperor himself. They did not follow cultic practices acceptable to Rome. That was both dangerous and actionable. Pliny, therefore, knew a simple way to see whether someone really was a Christian or not. Non-Christians would have no qualms about participating in a traditional cult. Christians who persisted in their views would rather die first. Then there arose the question about what to do with Christians who chose not to persist in their views. What should happen to someone who admitted to being a Christian previously, but who recanted? Pliny decided that such a person was not guilty of an offense and should be released unharmed. This is extraordinary. It means that Christianity was not a crime like any other crime. Anyone who commits murder cannot escape a judicial penalty by claiming that even though he had committed murder in the past, he was not murdering anyone in the present, and so he should not be punished. Murder, like all other crimes, is punishable for having been committed. Romans did not treat Christians that way. Having been a Christian was not a crime. Being a Christian was. Anyone who recanted and returned to traditional ways was acquitted. Pliny's logic was followed by later Roman officials as well. It was the logic of religious observance. Refusing to worship the traditional gods was not simply a matter of personal preference. It was a social and political issue as well, in part because, when not revered, the gods could bring communal disaster. Obdurate members of non-traditional cults who refused to participate in the religious life of the community therefore constituted a threat. Those who recognized the error of their ways, however, no longer posed a threat, and so did not need to be coerced into obedience. The gods were happy, the officials were happy, and the community was happy. There was then no need for punishment. In his letter, Pliny goes on to indicate that his interrogations of Christians revealed important information about their cultic practices. His comments show not only what Christians were doing in their communal services, but also by inference, what they were wrongly suspected of doing. Pliny indicates that the Christians came together to worship at dawn, and in their gatherings they sang antiphonal hymns to Christ as God. They also bound themselves by oaths to engage in highly ethical activities. They agreed to commit no crime, no theft, no adultery. They agreed never to break their word or to withhold money from someone who had deposited it with them. The Christians would then disband and gather again later to share a meal together, a food that Pliny indicates was common and harmless. These comments about Christian activities may seem rather straightforward and banal, yet they are anything but that. An understanding of Christian writings of the second century makes it quite easy to read between the lines to see what Pliny is actually saying. He is, in effect, indicating that the common rumors in circulation about Christian worship practices were unfounded. As we will see later in this chapter, Christians were accused of engaging in wild nocturnal rituals that involved profligate immorality, infanticide, and cannibalism. Pliny found nothing of the sort. The Christians were committed on oath to being unusually ethical, and they ate regular food, not human babies, in their periodic celebrations. Pliny appears not to have believed his own findings at first. He identified two slaves who served as deaconesses, or ministers, in the community, and had them tortured to find the truth. In Roman antiquity, it was believed, quite contrary to our own way of thinking, that only under extreme torture would a person necessarily speak truthfully. In judicial proceedings involving slaves, it was actually required that they be tortured. Pliny wanted the truth, but when tortured, the slaves revealed nothing scandalous, other than a debased and boundless superstition. Nonetheless, Pliny indicates the problems caused by this superstition were indeed significant. It had affected many of all ages, every rank, and both sexes, and was widespread. The infection of the superstition has extended not merely through the cities, but also through the villages and country areas. In fact, the local pagan temples had been virtually deserted, and there was almost no demand for sacrificial meat. That had all been rectified, however, by his intervention. Now that he had acted, the temples were once more crowded and the meat markets were beginning to thrive. Pliny clearly wanted the emperor's approbation for his way of proceeding, and he received it in a terse reply. Trajan does not invoke any imperial law that was to govern the case, the clearest indication of all that no such law existed, since if it had, the emperor of all people would surely know. On the contrary, Trajan indicates that in dealing with Christians, no general rule can be laid down which would establish a definite routine. Pliny's procedures were fine. In particular, anyone who denied being a Christian and proved it by worshiping our gods, even if previously suspected of adhering to the aberrant faith, was to be acquitted. Trajan does stress two provisos. Christians were not to be sought out. There was to be no witch hunt, no tracking down of criminals. Second, Trajan emphasizes, accusations could not be made anonymously. If someone had a charge to bring, they needed to bring it in person and stand by their claim. Documents published anonymously must play no role in any accusation, for they give the worst example and are foreign to our age. With that, Trajan's reply ends. It should be clear that there were simply no established procedures for dealing with Christians in the early 2nd century. Pliny's approach was clever and effective, but it was also ad hoc. He was not following precedent because he did not know any precedents. Some scholars have argued, however, that his procedure itself became a kind of precedent. Later officials acted in similar ways. Christians were to be forced to recant their faith and worship the traditional gods. Anyone who refused was guilty of a crime, ironically to our modern thinking, a crime without a law, and was to be punished accordingly, sometimes with torture and death. This did not happen frequently, but it did happen on occasion. It happened because people knew what being a Christian involved, and possibly even more because they suspected what it involved. That Pliny was not alone in his understanding of what being a Christian entailed is shown in writings of 2nd and 3rd century Christian intellectuals, who occasionally discussed their treatment at the hands of Roman officials. Among other things, these discussions show that Christians were known to be atheists engaged in regular acts of grotesque immorality. The Christian Atheists. It may come as a shock to learn that Christians on trial in the Roman world were maligned and punished for being atheists. Christians? Atheists? Aren't Christians precisely the opposite of atheists? That may be in modern times, when Christians believe in God and atheists believe there is no God. But the situation in antiquity was different. Virtually no one would ask a friend, "Do you believe in God?" In its barest form, the question presupposes a theology that almost no one held, namely that there is or may be one divine being in the universe and that it is possible to accept his existence or not. In the ancient world, any such view would have been considered bizarre at best. Nonetheless, the term atheist was used. Only rarely did it refer to someone who denied the existence of any divine being at all. Rather, it was used either to refer to those who thought the gods were radically disinterested and uninvolved with human affairs, that was the view of the Epicurean philosophers, or to those who did not ascribe any true divinity to the traditional gods. No one who participated in the regular religious life of the empire fit that category. The Jews were a partial exception, but even most Jews were completely open to Gentiles worshiping their pagan gods in any way they chose. The charge of atheism principally came to be applied, after the Epicureans, to Christians. They insisted not only that theirs was the only God, but also that a person needed to worship this God alone. None of the other gods was really a God. Worse still, Christians did not engage in widely recognized and accepted cultic acts, especially sacrifice. Because of their idiosyncratic views and practices, Christians were considered to be without the gods. They were the atheists. That this was not just a slur but an actual judicial charge becomes clear from the writings of the apologists, the intellectual defenders of the faith, including the witty but relatively obscure Athenagoras of Athens, who lists atheism as the first accusation typically leveled against the Christians. So too the second century Justin, who was himself eventually to be martyred for his faith, clearly states, "This is the sole charge you lodge against us, that we do not worship the same gods as you do. We have seen the reasons this would be a charge warranting punishment, not simply a religious concern. Religion was not stored in a separate compartment, apart from social and political life in antiquity. Not revering the city or state gods meant not being faithful to the city or state. On one level, it was the ancient equivalent of refusing to say the Pledge of Allegiance. But it was far more dangerous. The gods could harm the communities that refused to give them their due. Recall the chilling words of Tertullian on why pagans feared and despised the Christians. They think the Christians the cause of every public disaster, of every affliction with which the people are visited. If the Tiber rises as high as the city walls, if the Nile does not send its waters up over the fields, if the heavens give no rain, if there is an earthquake, if there is a famine or pestilence, straightway the cry is, 'Away with the Christians to the lion.'" Writing some five decades later in the middle of the third century, Cyprian, the bishop of Carthage, indicates that Christians are widely blamed for wars, plagues, famines, and droughts. "You have said that all these things are caused by us, and that to us ought to be attributed the misfortunes wherewith the world is now shaken and distressed, because your gods are not worshipped by us." Cyprian, too, was eventually martyred for his faith. Remarkably, in his case, we have a transcript of his trial, which appears to be reasonably unadorned and accurate. From it, we can see more fully the judicial charges brought against Christians. Cyprian had been a wealthy and highly educated aristocrat who made his living as a rhetorician. He converted to Christianity as an adult around 245 CE. Within 2 years, he was consecrated bishop of the largest church in North Africa. As a high-profile figure, he was under the eye of the local Roman authorities in the persecutions of the 250s, which we will examine later in this chapter. Finally, he was arrested on September 1st, 258, and put on trial 2 days later. The magistrate's summary of Cyprian's capital offense is worth citing in full. "You have long persisted in your sacrilegious views, and you have joined to yourself many other vicious men in a conspiracy. You have set yourself up as an enemy of the gods of Rome, and of our religious practices, and the pious and venerable emperors Valerian and Gallienus Augusti, and Valerian, the most noble of Caesars, have not been able to bring you back to the observance of their sacred rites. Thus, since you have been caught as the instigator and leader of a most atrocious crime, you will be an example for all those whom, in your wickedness, you have gathered to yourself. Discipline shall have its sanction in your blood. Theseus Cyprian is sentenced to die by the sword." The sentence was carried out immediately. Cyprian was beheaded. His crime, refusing to worship the gods of Rome. Christian flagrant immorality. We have seen that Pliny suspected the Christians of unethical and even criminal activities in their weekly meetings. Secret societies were always suspect, and the rumors about the Bacchanalia in an earlier age no doubt occasionally affected how people thought about Christians. Recall how Livy had reported that in those Bacchic feasts, all sorts of corruption began to be practiced, since each person had ready to hand the chance of gratifying the particular desire to which he was naturally inclined. These nocturnal festivities involved not only licentious sexual activities, but also the ritual murder of innocent and helpless victims. No cries for help could be heard against the shriekings, the banging of drums, and the clashing of cymbals in the scene of debauchery and bloodshed. We find Christians accused of similar outrageous behavior. Both Justin, around 150 CE, and Tertullian, some 50 years later, refer to the charges. In rather graphic terms, Tertullian indicates the allegations had even been ratcheted up a notch for the Christians to include not just murder, but cannibalism. "Monsters of wickedness, we are accused of observing a holy rite in which we kill a little child and then eat it, in which after the feast we practice incest. The dogs, our pimps forsooth, overturning the lights and getting us the shamelessness of darkness for our impious lusts. This is what is constantly laid to our charge." An even more detailed and shocking exposition of the charges is set forth in the Defense of the Faith, written by Tertullian's younger contemporary, Minucius Felix, who, according to tradition, had earlier been a lawyer in Rome. His only surviving work is called Octavius, named after its main character, who engages in a conversation with a pagan named Caecilian over the merits of the Christian faith, with Minucius Felix himself serving as the mediator between the two. The account is allegedly autobiographical, but if not made up wholesale, the back and forth has been heavily edited in Octavius's favor. His speech promoting Christianity takes up twice the space as Caecilian's attack on it, and at the end of the speech, the pagan is utterly convinced. Without further ado, he converts on the spot. Despite its fictitious features, there can be no doubt that the dialogue contains historically valid information, including the charges that Caecilian levels against the Christians. These reflect both the suspicions of Pliny from a century earlier and the statements of other writers, such as Tertullian later, even if they are unmatched in their gruesome vividness. Minucius Felix intimates that the charges derive from the writings of Marcus Cornelius Fronto, the famous rhetorician and one-time tutor of the great emperor Marcus Aurelius. Caecilian's emphatic castigation of the Christian religion comes in his description of their salacious nocturnal rituals. They recognize each other by secret marks and signs. Hardly have they met when they love each other, throughout the world uniting in the practice of a veritable religion of lusts. Indiscriminately, they call each other brother and sister, thus turning even ordinary fornication into incest. The Christians take a remarkable approach to these periodic love feasts, with an inventive way of turning out the lights to encourage anonymous and random sex. On a special day, they gather for a feast with all their children, sisters, mothers, all sexes and ages. There, flushed with the banquet after such feasting and drinking, they begin to burn with incestuous passions. They provoke a dog tied to the lampstand to leap and bound towards a scrap of food which they have tossed outside the reach of his chain. By this means, the light is overturned and extinguished, and with it common knowledge of their actions. In this shameless dark with unspeakable lust, they copulate in random unions, all equally being guilty of incest, some by deed, but everyone by complicity. It is not simply the sexual congress of consenting adults and children that offends Caecilius's ethics. Christians have a gruesome and criminal initiation ritual for new members. The notoriety of the stories told of the initiation of new recruits is matched by their ghastly horror. A young babe is covered over with flour, the object being to deceive the unwary. It is then served before the person to be admitted into their rites. The recruit is urged to inflict blows onto it. They appear to be harmless because of the covering of flour. Thus the baby is killed with wounds that remain unseen and concealed. It is the blood of this infant, I shudder to mention it. It is this blood that they lick with thirsty lips. These are the limbs they distribute eagerly. This is the victim by which they seal their covenant. It is by complicity in this crime that they are pledged to mutual silence. These are their rites, more foul than all sacrileges combined. So this is what it means to be Christian. Modern readers may find it incredible that anyone could take such scurrilous reports seriously. But they must have done so. Otherwise, we would not have such a consistent allusion to them. Still, how could anyone credit them? It is important to remember that Christian meetings were private and secret. The Christian church was not the building on the street corner. It was a gathering of believers in a private home or a secluded outdoor setting. These meetings usually occurred at night or before sunrise in the dark. There was a very good reason for that. Almost everyone had to work for a living, and in this world, there were no weekends. Any meeting would have to take place outside of working hours. But who knew what those people were doing in the dark? Scholars have had a field day suggesting additional explanations for why the outrageous activities mentioned by Justin, Tertullian, Minucius Felix, and others came to be associated with Christian meetings in particular. Some have pointed out that charges of incest make sense for a sect in which brothers and sisters regularly engaged in the holy kiss as far back as New Testament times. Siblings kissing in the dark? What is that? As to the charge that Christians were killing babies and eating them, surely it was known that Christians had a special meal every week where they ate the flesh and drank the blood of the Son of God. They were eating a child? Other scholars have expressed doubt that charges of profligate activities stemmed from an imperfect knowledge of Christians and their periodic meetings. Charges of sexual licentiousness, infanticide, and cannibalism were standard fare in ancient polemics of all sorts. Anyone wanting to malign their enemies could, and often would, say the most scandalous things imaginable to impugn their morals. There was nothing more scandalous than energetically engaging in incest, murdering children, and consuming their flesh and blood. So while it is possible that imperfect knowledge influenced the charges occasionally leveled against the Christians, these may also simply be standard charges leveled against an unknown but hated group, attacked not only in court, but also in scurrilous public opinion. Early accounts of the martyrs. Actual judicial charges against Christians do not appear to have been related to sexual improprieties or other flagrant forms of immorality. This much is clear from the accounts of Christian prosecution, conviction, and execution that have survived antiquity. Unfortunately, trial records are few and far between. As Candida Moss, a historian of early Christianity, has recently argued, we have only 6 martyrdom accounts handed down to us from before 250 CE, and 2 or 3 of these may be forgeries. 1 or 2 of the others, however, appear to be based on actual eyewitness testimony, and all of them contain historical information that can be gleaned from a close reading. In particular, they support what we have seen from Pliny. The crime committed by the followers of Jesus was simply their refusal to renounce the name Christian, since this entailed a refusal to worship gods other than their own. Pagans, on the whole, had no difficulty with Christians worshiping whichever god they chose, so long as they did not oppose or resist worshiping other divinities as well. That is what everyone else in the world did, except Jews, who for centuries had been the exception. Christians were not an exception. They were non-Jews who spurned traditional religions. That was a punishable offense. One of the oldest surviving accounts of a Christian martyrdom involves the arrest and execution of Polycarp, a mid-second century bishop in the city of Smyrna in Asia Minor, and an important figure in early Christianity. The martyrdom of Polycarp was long believed to be an eyewitness report produced not long after the event itself, often dated to 155 or 156 CE. Recent scholarship, however, has argued that the narrative is a forgery produced sometime in the early 3rd century. Whatever its precise date, the account reveals how Christians understood the charges leveled against them, and shows that Roman magistrates responsible for issuing a sentence often did so only with great reluctance, compelled principally by the urgings of the mob. The account is allegedly a letter sent by the Christians of Smyrna to those of Philomelium in what is now central Turkey. At the outset, the anonymous author indicates his intentions. We are writing you, brothers, about those who were martyred along with the blessed Polycarp, who put an end to the persecution by, as it were, setting a seal on it through his death as martyr. For nearly everything leading up to his death occurred so that the Lord might show us, from above, a martyrdom in conformity with the gospel. We clearly do not have a disinterested report here. The author's guiding purpose is to show that Polycarp's death mirrored that of Jesus, so that it was in conformity with the gospel. He attains this end through a number of literary touches. Like Jesus as portrayed in the Gospels, Polycarp does not turn himself in, but waits to be betrayed. He predicts to his followers his coming execution and its specific method. He prays intensely before being arrested, asking that God's will be done. The official in charge of his arrest is named Herod, and Polycarp rides into town on a donkey. Moreover, like Jesus, the martyr Polycarp is calm and fearless in the face of death. The author foreshadows this divinely inspired bravery by providing a brief narrative of other Christians subjected to torture during the violent persecution. For they endured even when their skin was ripped to shreds by whips, revealing the very anatomy of their flesh, down to the inner veins and arteries, while bystanders felt pity and wailed. But they displayed such nobility that none of them either grumbled or moaned, clearly showing us all that in that hour, while under torture, the martyrs of Christ has journeyed far away from the flesh, or rather, that the Lord was standing by, speaking to them. The crowd, not sated by these gory deaths, calls for the arrest of their leader. Away with the atheists! Find Polycarp! Following a long account of his search and arrest, Polycarp, once in custody, is urged by the arresting party simply to do what he is being asked. Why is it so wrong to save yourself by saying Caesar is Lord, making a sacrifice, and so on?